From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Gaza conflict. A Liberian doctor dies from Ebola. Nigeria's doctors strike, threatening HIV/AIDS care, plus Boko Haram suspected in Cameroon kidnappings. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. UN Security Council agreed Sunday on a statement calling for an immediate and unconditional humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza and then scheduled a meeting to adopt it. Officials, including President Obama, have continued to try to find a lasting halt to the fighting. Mr. Obama told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during a telephone call on Sunday that he was concerned about the number of civilian casualties and underscored the importance of Israel's security and alleviating Gaza's humanitarian crisis. After that phone call took place, Israeli forces began shelling in the Gaza Strip hours after Hamas declared a 24-hour ceasefire. The Israeli government said it was resuming military operations because Palestinian fighters had not observed previous calls for a truce. VOA's Scott Bobb is in Jerusalem with our report.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told television viewers on the U.S.-based CBS program Face the Nation that Hamas had violated several previous ceasefires by continuing to fire rockets from Gaza into Israel.
They violated their own ceasefire, and they're firing at us as we speak. So Israel is not obliged and will not let a terrorist organization to decide when, and it's convenient for them to stop for a moment, rearm, and continuing firing on our citizens and our people.
The Hamas group that controls Gaza had declared a 24-hour temporary ceasefire until midday Monday as residents prepared to mark the end of Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting and atonement. Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri. He says, in response to the assessment of the United Nations and taking into consideration the condition of our people in Gaza, especially in the light of the coming Eid holiday, there was discussion between the factions. He said they have reached an agreement to accept the offer of a 24-hour humanitarian calm starting from 2 o'clock Sunday. Five ceasefires have been proposed since the fighting began nearly 3 weeks ago. Except for a 12-hour pause on Saturday, none have been observed by both parties. Palestinian officials said more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed and about 6,000 wounded in the conflict, most of them civilians. Israel says 43 of its soldiers have been killed, as well as 3 civilians. Israel launched the operation in Gaza to destroy rocket launching installations and infiltration tunnels into Israel. The military says more than 30 tunnels have been destroyed. Western diplomats have been trying to negotiate an Egyptian proposal that would allow a one-week ceasefire, but each side has posed conditions that the other side does not appear ready to accept. Israel wants a demilitarized Gaza, while Hamas says Israel should end its blockade of the enclave and cease all aggression. Several thousand Israelis demonstrated in Tel Aviv Saturday night for an end to the fighting. At the same time, several hundred protesters staged a counter-demonstration nearby in support of the Israeli military operation. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
A violent 24 hours in Libya has left 61 people dead, raising the death toll to nearly 150 in 2 weeks of clashes. Estimated 38 people were killed in the eastern city of Benghazi as Libyan government forces clashed with armed Islamist militants on Saturday and Sunday. And Egyptian workers were among the 23 dead in the Libyan capital, Tripoli, where deadly fighting between rival militias is entering a third week. Nearly 100 people have died in ongoing airport clashes in Tripoli alone since early July as government forces struggle to control the worst surge in violence in the country that it's seen since the 2011 war that ousted leader Muammar Gaddafi. Nigeria's Boko Haram militants kidnapped the wife of Cameroon's vice prime minister and the mayor of a town near the Nigerian border Sunday. Three others were killed when heavily armed men suspected to be part of Boko Haram raided homes in Kalafata in the northern part of the country. Sunday's attack is the third by Boko Haram in Cameroon since Friday. A senior doctor working at Liberia's largest hospital has died of Ebola. The Liberian Health Ministry says Dr. Samuel Brisbane died Saturday at an Ebola treatment center on the outskirts of the capital, Monrovia. He is the first Liberian doctor to die in the outbreak, the World Health Organization says, has killed 129 people in the country. The U.S.-based aid group Samaritan's Purse said Saturday an American doctor working in Liberia is also sick with Ebola. Dr. Kent Brantley has fluctuating high fever and is being treated, as we hear now from Samaritan Purse's spokesperson, Melissa Strickland.
He has body aches, pains, typical Ebola symptoms. He's receiving intensive medical support and care from our Samaritan's Purse team there on the ground. And we are hopeful for his recovery, but Ebola is an incredibly dangerous, deadly disease. So it is very premature to say that he's out of the woods.
Is he being treated in the same hospital where Nancy Reitbol was a missionary? I believe she also has symptoms of the disease.
That's correct. And they are both on the compound at Elwha Hospital in Monrovia.
And her group...
And they are both being treated by our team there.
Great. Her group runs the hospital, is that correct?
That's correct. She is a missionary with SIM, and SIM runs Elwha Hospital there. And we have partnered with them very closely in battling this Ebola outbreak in Liberia.
We've heard from the World Health Organization and others that are saying that this is likely the largest outbreak of Ebola ever recorded. Many, many dead, and not sure where it's going just yet. It must be creating a huge challenge, not only for groups like yours, but I would think for the countries and where this is prevalent right now and their medical infrastructure.
Absolutely. You're dealing with countries who are in the developing world. They do not have the kind of infrastructure that we would see here in the United States. And the population, there's a lot of superstition, a lot of stigma associated with the disease, a lot of misinformation associated with the disease. So along with our direct clinical care, the treatment of Ebola patients themselves, we and other organizations have undertaken significant public awareness campaigns to reach communities, educate them both on recognizing symptoms early and on the prevention of the disease. But absolutely, we've got a tremendous battle on our hands.
We've been reporting for some time now about this disease being prevalent not only in Liberia, where Dr. Brantley's located, but in Sierra Leone as well as Guinea. Some have talked about trying to do something to contain it within those three countries, lockdown, whatever the term might be. What is your group's view of containment of Ebola?
We are not advocating lockdown, if you mean ceasing international travel, closing the airports, that kind of thing. We have not taken that stance in any way officially. What we need to do to contain the disease is to continue to provide education, continue to identify patients early, get them treatment, dispose of bodies properly, et cetera. What we need is a significant international effort to battle this disease, and we welcome other NGOs and other agencies who will come alongside us in this fight.
Melissa Strickland is with the aid group Samaritan's Purse. She was speaking with us late on Sunday. For more on the group's work with Ebola patients in West Africa, you can go to their website. That's SamaritansPurse.org. Nearly a month into a nationwide doctor's strike, HIV/AIDS patients in some parts of northern Nigeria say health care is rapidly declining and they have become largely dependent upon foreign aid organizations. Doctors say the strike is the only way they know to rescue Nigeria's flailing health care system, but nurses accuse strikers of abandoning public care in favor of more lucrative private practices. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja.
The Nigerian Medical Association says about 30,000 members have been on strike since the beginning of July, breaking the strike only to provide emergency care for victims of frequent insurgent attacks. But HIV patients say they need life-saving care just as much as victims of terrorism. Benjamin Daniel leads a network of people living with HIV or AIDS in the northern city of Kaduna. He says some HIV/AIDS patients have already been turned away from emergency care. And as the strike drags on, more people are getting sick.
These doctor strike are actually affected the life of people living with HIV and AIDS in Kaduna State. And if the government didn't do anything about it, definitely I'm telling you, we don't know the fate of our people.
In Kaduna Wednesday, doctors broke their strike to treat injured victims of a double bombing that killed 44 people. When those patients were stable, they left. Nigeria's official HIV infection rate is more than 4%, and some doctors say that rate is grossly underestimated. But HIV/AIDS drugs are still available, says the executive secretary of the Kaduna State AIDS Control Agency, Haliru Musa Abubakar. Because they don't need doctors to distribute medicine.
We are trying as much as possible to see that the strike, you know, doesn't affect negatively, you know, the patient's access to the drugs. So far, we have not had any problem in the state.
While strikes are common tools for negotiation in Nigeria, this is the first time the Nigerian Medical Association has called a nationwide strike, union officials say. The strike will continue, they add, until the government provides more resources to hospitals. Union members say without these resources, the Nigerian hospital system will collapse in a matter of years. The National Association of Nigerian Nurses and Midwives has called the strike selfish, saying doctors are trying to divert patients into their own expensive private clinics. Andy Bako is a local coordinator of the Association of Vulnerable Children in Nigeria. He blames the government for the strike, saying its refusal to negotiate with doctors puts everyone at risk.
For children that fall sick from time to time, certainly they don't access treatment because they go to the conventional hospital to receive treatment. They go no doctors and it's really affecting them.
Bako says HIV/AIDS patients still have a modicum of care because foreign aid organizations are still operating. However, he says dependency on groups that could potentially leave Nigeria because of the growing Boko Haram insurgency is as dangerous as it is frightening.
That is Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Later on International Edition, eliminating chronic hepatitis.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Fighting between Ukrainian government forces and separatist rebels killed at least 18 people in Donetsk on Sunday. Rebels say two children were among the 13 dead in the city of Horlivka, where another five people were killed in clashes in a suburb north of Donetsk. Police monitors from Australia and the Netherlands postponed their plans on Sunday to visit the Malaysian airliner crash site in eastern Ukraine, citing security concerns as fighting continued in the area. Meantime, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte told journalists at The Hague on Sunday that international military would not be sent to the secure crash site of the downed passenger plane. Pro-Russian separatists remain in control of the area where the Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 was brought down on July 17th on a flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, killing all 298 on board.
Het gebied staat onder controle van separatisten. die beschikken over veel...
Rutte, flanked by the Dutch foreign defense and justice ministers, said the situation at the crash site remains too volatile. He said achieving military superiority through an international mission in the area is not realistic, not even if they have massive military buildup to secure the crash site. Majority of the passengers on Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 were Dutch citizens. United States officials have released satellite images they say show that Russia has fired rockets against Ukrainian forces in the last week in support of the separatist rebels. The images show what the U.S. government says are multiple rocket launchers and self-propelled howitzers on Russian territory. Other images show impact craters near military positions on the Ukrainian side of the border and what Washington says is Russian-supplied heavy weaponry being fired by separatists from within Ukraine between July the 21st and July 26th. The images released Sunday support statements by a White House spokesman last week that the U.S. had detected rockets fired from Russia into Ukraine. Moscow is denying directly intervening in the Ukrainian conflict or that it had any role in the downing of that Malaysian passenger plane. Senior British official is calling for the 2018 World Cup to be moved from Russia as punishment for the country's role in the Ukraine crisis, as calls intensify from both sides of the Atlantic for tougher sanctions on Moscow. Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg demanded stricter sanctions and the removal of the tournament from Russia due to what he told the Sunday Times newspaper, was an ugly aggression of Russia on the Russia-Ukrainian border. International Football Authority FIFA said Friday that the event will stay in Russia. And German lawmakers have also called for the international sporting event to be moved following Russia's alleged involvement in the shooting down of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. Meantime, a top U.S. security official said Sunday he expected European sanctions on Russia to stiffen in the coming days as well. World Health Organization reports viral hepatitis, which kills nearly 1.5 million people a year, could be eliminated. In marking World Hepatitis Day, which is today, the WHO says intensifying testing and prevention and treatment efforts is key to attacking one of the world's most serious diseases. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Viral hepatitis is a largely neglected disease. This may seem strange, as this dangerous alphabet of infectious diseases, hepatitis A, B, C, D, and E, kills nearly as many people as does HIV/AIDS. Hepatitis B and C are most well known and justifiably feared because they cause chronic liver cirrhosis and liver cancer, very often leading to death. Hepatitis B is transmitted from an infected mother to her newborn baby, contact with infected blood, and unprotected sex. Injected drug users are most at risk from hepatitis C, as the disease is spread through the unsafe sharing of needles. Samuel So is a liver transplant surgeon at Stanford University in the United States. He says prevention is the best cure for liver cancer, as there is no effective chemotherapy to treat this disease, which is the second leading cause of cancer deaths after lung cancer. Despite this, he says viral hepatitis can be beaten, a view confirmed by health ministers who attended this year's World Health Assembly. He calls on countries to step up their activities now to eliminate these deadly diseases.
We have a very effective vaccine for 30 years to prevent the future burden of hepatitis B, so they don't develop chronic hepatitis and subsequent liver cirrhosis and liver cancer. And also, in addition, there are now very effective drugs to treat chronic hepatitis B, which is as simple as a pill a day. And you can prevent, like HIV, prevent disease progression to cirrhosis and liver cancer.
The World Health Organization reports more than 500 million people around the world are living with chronic viral hepatitis. About 2/3 of global deaths occur in Asia. The virus also is common in African countries. Most people with hepatitis do not know they are infected. Symptoms usually appear decades after serious liver disease already has set in. This is why WHO urges governments to invest in effective prevention measures. Nevertheless, head of WHO's Global Hepatitis Program, Stefan Victor, says people have reason to be optimistic as great advances are being made in new treatments.
Much of the recent excitement in the area of hepatitis is because of the therapeutic revolution in hepatitis C, and we have a number of new medicines that are have either been approved or and a lot more about to be approved, which really are revolutionizing how we treat hepatitis by shortening the course of treatment to as little as 12 weeks, and in the future maybe even shorter. It's no more injections, these drugs are safe, and they cure almost everybody. It's like 90-95% of people are cured.
But money is a problem. Patients in the United States have to pay $84,000 for a 12-week course of treatment. Dr. Victor agrees this price is out of reach for most people in the world, especially in developing countries. However, he says he expects the price to come down rapidly. He notes just last month, Egypt negotiated an agreement with the manufacturer to receive the drug at a cost of $900 per patient for the 12-week course of treatment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Vincenzo Nibali is the first Italian cyclist to win the Tour de France in 16 years. Lisa Bryant has our report.
Eh bien, illégal sur ce Tour de France. Vincenzo Nibali, vainqueur.
29-year-old Sicilian Vincenzo Nibali cruised to victory on a summer's evening in Paris, winning by a total of 7.37 minutes over Frenchman Jean-Christophe Perrault. Another Frenchman, rising 24-year-old star Thibaut Pinot, was third overall. German Marcel Kittel won Sunday's final stage in a sprint finish. Nibali is the first Italian to win the Tour de France since 1998. He's also only one of six cyclists to win all three Grand Tours, France, Italy, and Spain. His victory came after pre-race favorites, defending champion Chris Froome of Britain and two-time winner Alberto Contador of Spain, bowed out earlier with injuries. Speaking from the victory podium at the Champs-Élysées, Nibali said it was one of the most beautiful moments in his life. He thanked his team and his family. Thousands of people watched the riders make their final loops in the French capital, ending a race that began in the British city of Leeds on July 5th. Matthew Antony had cycled here from London with a medical group.
We finished yesterday a four-day ride covering over 330 miles, and we're celebrating today by seeing a bit of professional cycling, seeing how fast the real people do it.
14-year-old Natalia Mestering is from Toronto.
Amazing. This is honestly an experience of a lifetime. I'm so excited to be here.
Pierre Gonard from the French city of Rouen was here with his father. The Gonard said they were happy to be on the Champs-Élysées to watch the riders finish. They've seen the Tour before in the mountains when the teams flash by in seconds. The riders lucked out on this last 137.5 kilometer leg of the Tour. After enduring stretches of rain and cold during the 3 weeks, they ended with sunshine for their last stage of the 101st Tour de France. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And South African golfer Tim Clark rallied to win the Canadian Open on Sunday with a one-stroke victory over Jim Furyk. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. Two classical music greats died on this day. In 1741, Italian composer Antonio Vivaldi died. The German composer Johann Sebastian Bach, considered by some to be the greatest composer of all time, died on this day in 1750. In 1868, following the U.S. Civil War, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was officially ratified and made part of the Constitution. The amendment was designed to grant citizenship to and protect the civil liberties of recently freed slaves. On this day in 1900, Louis Lassing served hamburgers at his diner in New Haven, Connecticut. It is one of the many claims to the invention of the hamburger, one of America's most popular foods. Today is observed as National Hamburger Day in honor of the occasion. In 1914, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. Following the assassination of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Due to a series of alliances, many nations soon found themselves involved in the Great War, or World War I. On this day in 1943, during World War II, more than 700 British bombers dropped 2,300 tons of incendiary bombs on Hamburg, Germany, killing at least 42,000 people. In 1945, a U.S. Army B-25 bomber crashed into the Empire State Building in New York City in heavy fog, killing 14 people and injuring 26. In 1959, elections in the then-new U.S. state of Hawaii sent the first Asian Americans to Congress. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Iran and the P5 plus one countries, coordinated by the European Union, have decided to extend the joint plan of action until November 24th and continue negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. For the past 6 months, the parties have been working on a comprehensive agreement aimed at assuring the international community that Iran will not acquire a nuclear weapon and that its nuclear program is for exclusively peaceful purposes. The negotiations between Iran and the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany will now be extended for 4 months past the original target date of July 20th, imposed by the parties under last November's First Step Nuclear Agreement, called the Joint Plan of Action, or JPOA. The International Atomic Energy Agency recently confirmed that Iran has carried out the very significant commitments it made and has taken steps to address the international community's greatest concerns. The JPOA resulted in a rollback of Iran's nuclear program in return for modest sanctions relief. Referring to the past 6 months, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said in a statement, "We have made tangible progress in our comprehensive negotiations, but there are very real gaps in some areas. Ultimately, our goal in pursuing this brief extension is to capitalize on the progress we've already made, while giving us the best chance of success at the end of this process. Critically, Iran's nuclear program will remain halted during the next 4 months. This is in our interest and in the interest of our allies," Secretary of State Kerry said. 1 year ago, few would have predicted that Iran would have kept all its commitments under a first-step nuclear agreement and that we would be actively negotiating a long-term comprehensive agreement. Now we have 4 additional months to determine the next miles of this difficult diplomatic journey. "Let's all commit to seize this moment," Mr. Kerry said, "and to use the additional time to make the fundamental choices necessary to conclude a comprehensive agreement that makes the entire world a safer place."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.